Welcome to an hour by the window at the White Network. I'm your host, August. Greetings, listeners, and this is the third installment of An Hour by the Window. I took the advice of one of my contacts, Vic Fury, and obtained a microphone with this boom feature on the tip, so I hope this program will be cleaner than the previous ones. You know, since childhood, I've had a fascination with windows. At an early age, I would exert great effort cloaking the outside world with the darkest curtain, hoping that in doing so, things would change outside to my liking. I would gaze up during homework or play and wonder that if I should open up the window, I would suddenly find myself in another world, as if my home were capable of such travel. My overactive imagination, I would look at the window and imagine opening it up to see ancient Rome, see some peasant gazing at a field at the twilight of the Middle Ages, or a march into defeated France in 1940. Even now, as I have an unwritten short story about a man and that literally sees the world through the reflection of mirrors and the visage of windows, and that normal means of sight and experience are a haze to him. The window is not just a concrete object, it is also a metaphor. It is a metaphor for revelation and discernment. The window that I open on this program reveals little that is not already there for others to see, though. Many of us have already seen these things. I can only hope that in sitting by this window with you, whatever wonders are there to be seen, I may, even if in the smallest way, interpret and clarify and elucidate. So may we look out of the window together and see the world in ways it is not already seen. Tonight, I want to talk about an issue that's very important to me, and that's the relevance of revisionism and the antagonists that exert some effort to discredit it, either from a non-racialist point of view or from a racialist and nationalist perspective. This has come to the fore in some recent discussions in our movement. On the White Network, for example, Carolyn interviewed Jet Rucker from the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust. She also interviewed another revisionist. And some blogs have been posted in response to an article by Greg Johnson of the Occidental Observer. Type in revisionism at the network search engine and to pull these up. Now I want to clarify in tonight's program some sense of the term relevance. Exactly what do I mean by that? Well, I mean it in two senses, historical and political. Obviously, revisionism has historical relevance, but it is the narrative of history that has changed in the act of revising. Sometimes revision is subtle, as when the details of some battle are altered in light of new evidence. At other times, revisionism is drastic, as when some event in the past that has long been believed to have occurred is in fact established to never have occurred at all. The political relevance of revisionism is slightly different. It emerges, well, maybe not slightly, quite drastically different, because of the implications involved. It emerges when revising an historical event has some concrete legal, ethical, or social impact on a group of people in the present. Sometimes the motive to revise may be partly political. For example, from 1932 to 1933, a very large number of Ukrainians died in the Soviet Great Famine. Estimates range from anywhere from 2 million to 7 million, though original estimates had put the death total at 10 million. Ukrainians have viewed this as an act of genocide by the Soviet regime, though its efforts to do so have been hampered by both the Russian government and, interestingly, by Jewish groups and the State of Israel. In this case, revisionism has both a political motive, that of Ukrainian nationalism, and also a political relevance, especially in the case of Jews, who were important agents in the Great Famine, or, as the Ukrainians name it, the Holodomor. Jews objected to the Ukrainian claim of genocide because it implicates Jews for complicity in the event. When I speak of revisionism, I'm referring, of course, in this context, to Holocaust revisionism. The accepted, publicly espoused narrative is that the German government implemented a plan of deliberate genocide against the Jews of Europe, and that as a result, approximately 6 million Jews lost their lives. Authentic Holocaust revisionists argue that there was no plan for mass extermination, that European Jews were deported east because they were considered enemies of the state, and that the death total of Jews is far lower than the 6 million figure that is the standard accepted number of the public. In fact, revisionists have shown that not only is the death total likely less than 1 million, probably hovering at about 500,000, in fact, the number of Jews interned in concentration camps is far lower than has been accepted. The work of the German statistician and architect Walter N. Sanning, in his book The Dissolution of East European Jewry, establishes this fact on the basis of multiple sources and careful statistical analysis. Now, for my listeners who are not versed in revisionism and revisionist issues, Holocaust revisionism has been an active field since after World War II ended. Propaganda in the war had already formed the basis of what later would become the Holocaust narrative. Many notable revisionists include David Irving, Mark Weber, Ernst Sindel, and Robert Farrison, and the principal fulcrum of their work has been the Institute for Historical Review, with its publication, The Journal for Historical Review. Another significant entity is CODO, the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, run by Bradley Smith. Of course, not all revisionists are racial nationalists. Some consider their enterprise simply a matter of historical truth. Their efforts span decades and are represented in numerous publications, books, pamphlets, and films. Even more removed are those completely outside of both the academic establishment and not directly lodged within revisionist groups, such as the IHR or CODO. Patrick J. Buchanan, for example, whose book I briefly discussed in my second show, demonstrates that the enterprise of revisionism is open to anyone with a sufficient grasp of the facts and a willingness to pen their thoughts and make them available to others. Now, I want to evoke Patrick J. Buchanan's book once again because I think that it is illustrative. It demonstrates that not only does revisionism have two facets, namely its historical element and its often political implications, but that the act of revising itself, the attempt to rewrite history, can proceed in two ways. The first is that we can simply demonstrate that the truths, or a truth, that we have clung to are actually false, and therefore alter our view of the past. An example would be altering the details of a political conference, say the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Another revisionist act is to suggest that someone in the past should have undertaken an action differently than he in fact did. This is another form of revisionism, and it's more subtle than the first because it does not necessarily rearrange the facts of history. Very often, it marshals the facts of history and then contextualizes them to the decision or act that the revisionist thinks should have been performed otherwise. In philosophy, the distinction I'm making here is between descriptive claims and normative claims. The act of revising a fact of history as a matter of truth is a descriptive act. Something is described differently than it has been believed to be. The act of suggesting that an historical figure should have done and act differently or made a different decision is what we call a normative claim. The distinction here is between what was the case and what should have been the case. Do you see the difference? Patrick J. Buchanan's book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, How Britain Lost Its Empire and the West Lost the World, is a fine example of normative revisionism. properly, it does not qualify as the kind of revisionist literature that falls under the umbrella of revising facts. Buchanan's book, which is an updated summation of many works before him, tells us that a certain figure or certain figures, given conditions then apparent to them, could have and in fact should have acted differently. He argues, for example, that British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain could have withheld a war guarantee to Poland, and should have done that, and that given Britain's actual inability to save Poland, which in any event Churchill later handed to Stalin, Chamberlain should simply have drawn a line of inviolate demarcation over France and the Low Countries, with the same way that Cold War-era Western leaders adopted a policy of containment against the Soviet Union. Thus, if British leaders had taken stock of their actual interests as an empire and assessed a realistic inability to defend Poland, they should have adopted a foreign policy toward Germany analogous to America's policy toward the Soviet Union, which was not to declare a suicidal war, but to ensure the safety and security of Britain's homeland, its empire, and its allies in Europe, including France and the Low Countries. This kind of revisionism tells us this. People in the past had certain motives, intentions, and the like, and they were confronted with certain realities. They should have acted differently than the way they did, and had every justification to do so. It's not simply a matter of hindsight. They possessed foresight in their good situations. Contrast this normative revisionism with the descriptive revisionism of many revisionists, including David Irving. In his book, Hitler's War, he argues that Hitler had no knowledge of the event called the Holocaust. Apart from the fact that many revisionists today, including Carolyn Yeager and Robert Farson, have serious misgivings about the yielding to the Holocaust narrative and the subscription of David Irving and Mark Weber to the belief that a Holocaust occurred, when in fact it did not, my point here is that the act of revising some presumed fact in this case amounts to a descriptive claim. It is descriptive revisionism. It takes some presumably established fact and discards it in favor of another. Revising Holocaust history fundamentally involves the use of evidence and facts to establish that the event is not what it has been touted in media and education. Its most fundamental claim amounts to a denial, a rejection, that the event even occurred, that Jews were not placed in concentration camps for the purpose of extermination, but for internment for being enemies of the state. Death occurred from disease and other factors, including localized killings, but it does not add up to a deliberate mass campaign of extermination. David Irving and Mark Weber, the long-established revisionists, have come to accept the Holocaust narrative in its prevalent form. Robert Farson, however, and others, do not concede that there is evidence for a Holocaust, and in contrast to Irving and Weber, holds that the event never occurred. Irving and Weber therefore presume to revise facets of a Holocaust story they accept, altering its details, while the efforts of Farrison and others revise and displace the very notion that a Holocaust ever even occurred. So I hope you see some contrasts there, some important distinctions. The difference between normative and descriptive revisionism becomes important when we consider the attacks on revisionism and the motivations for the attack. There are, in fact, two approaches to attacking the revisionist enterprise, both from completely distinct regions of political and social concern. I wish to spend the rest of this first half of the show introducing these, and then consume the second half of the show clarifying them and offering a defense of revisionism against both positions. One attack on revisionism is based on the claim that Holocaust revisionism, at least outside the academic establishment, is a fringe, pseudoscientific enterprise. One of the most prominent individuals to advance this view is Michael Shermer, who is a Holocaust historian and editor for Skeptic magazine. Shermer has written many books and has appeared on many different shows. In fact, studying as an undergraduate, I was present when he gave a discussion at one point. Shermer claims that Holocaust revisionists, particularly those at the Institute for Historical Review, or for the Committee on Open Debate of the Holocaust, exhibit characteristics similar to people who espouse biblical creationism and intelligent design. The attack amounts to the claim that Holocaust revisionism is not real academic history, and is based on central claims that are not only questionable, but scientifically doubtful. Schirmer claims that it is conspiratorial and motivated by unfounded beliefs about Jews and Jewish activity. What it reduces to is an attempt to legitimize a presumably false political perspective with crypto-history and pseudoscience. To the anti-revisionist, Holocaust revisionism masks unfounded racial discrimination. And what underlies this form of anti-revisionist position is no less a political position than the one we possess, however. As Michael Schirmer says at the end of his essay, The New Revisionism, he refers to all mankind as one people and one folk. It's clear to me what Michael Schirmer's actual views are. In strict political terms, he is a typical globalist. He cares nothing about people of European descent, to the extent that it would motivate or eventuate in claims about their interests. Hence his callous treatment of revisionist authors and their motives in the article that I mentioned. His disregard for the substance of their articles about the decline of our race and about the decline of the West. These are matters of indifference to him. Another critique of revisionism has arisen within our movement itself. This particular criticism stems from a different motive. It is to treat revisionism as if it were a serious hindrance at worst, and a potential distraction at best. Greg Johnson's article, Dealing with the Holocaust, exemplifies this approach, and the generally standoffish approach to Holocaust revisionism in other areas of our movement. According to Johnson, Holocaust revisionism is irrelevant to our political goals and aims. He treats the issue with a heavy dose of incessant moralizing and sentimentalism, and it is apparent that he views that revisionist enterprise is insensitive. In addition to decrying Holocaust revisionism, he is also a supporter of the existence of the State of Israel, which he claims is necessary for people of European descent. In other words, Johnson represents that portion of our movement that wants to appeal to Jewish interests and sentiments. Now, in the second half of the show, I want to treat these positions in a little more detail. I'm going to consider the substance of the points that Schirmer and Johnson make. Now, though I'm not a professional revisionist myself, I am very sensitive to the political implications of any opposition and the motive that drives it to revisionism. And that's our fundamental concern tonight, and I hope you'll join me in the second half after the break, and we'll talk soon. Welcome back, listeners. Now I want to return to what I believe are two principal antagonists to the revisionist enterprise, particularly Holocaust revisionism, and those that make great strides and exert great effort within it. On the one hand, there is Michael Shermer, who purports to oppose much of Holocaust revisionism with the backing of science, branding Holocaust revisionism a pseudoscientific enterprise with a barely masked racial underpinning. On the other hand, there are individuals such as Greg Johnson, who are members of our movement to promote the interest of our race, but believe that Holocaust revisionism is irrelevant to our cause and often a distraction to our goals. I'm going to spend the rest of this program dealing with the substance of their arguments, and then end by making some general points of my own. The substance of Michael Shermer's position can be found in his book, Why People Believe Weird Things. And of course you can view Greg Johnson's article at the Occidental Observer, titled Dealing with the Holocaust. I think their views summarize what I would consider the two primary obstacles to those, like myself, who are sensitive to the smug dismissals of revisionism, whether it emanates from people like Shermer that wear the cloak of clean science, or people like Johnson, who are fundamentally confused and infect others in our movement with a meme that promotes empathy with Jewish interests and aims. In his book, Why People Believe Weird Things, Shermer's views culminate in a dismissal of Holocaust revisionism as a fringe group akin in its efforts to the tactics and methods of biblical creationists, whom he also treats in that book in a separate chapter. Holocaust revisionism is, to Shermer, pseudo-science. And the implication of his argument is that anything that is tainted with pseudoscience should therefore be ignored or pushed to the so-called fringe. He cites a list of characteristics provided by John George and Laird Wilcox in general characteristics that fringe groups possess. 1. Absolute certainty that they have the truth. 2. America is controlled to a greater or lesser extent by a conspiratorial group. In fact, they believe that this evil group is very powerful and controls most nations. 3. Open hatred of opponents, because these opponents, actually enemies in the extremist size, are seen as part of or sympathizers with the conspiracy. They deserve hatred and contempt. 4. Little faith in the democratic process, mainly because most people believe the conspiracy has such influence in the U.S. government, and therefore extremists usually spurn compromise. 5. Willingness to deny basic civil liberties to certain fellow citizens, because enemies deserve no liberties. 6. Consistent indulgence in irresponsible accusations and character accusations. Shermer folds in biblical creationism with so-called Holocaust denial, or revisionism, under this rubric. As social entities, Shermer claims, both exhibit these traits. This contrast has also been made, or comparison has been made, by the geneticist Richard Dawkins, likening Holocaust denial to creationism, probably in his efforts to win support from Jewish interests. Like Dawkins, Shermer has a specific set of political goals and aims. Shermer is clearly a political liberal and a globalist in orientation. It is important to identify these goals because under the mask of good science, such individuals publicize their views and exhibit their politically motivated positions as if they were embedded in the legitimate science that presumably reinforces them. I will say more on this later. For now, I want to focus on the specific claims about revisionism that Shermer makes in regards to its methods. Not only are Holocaust revisionists, according to Shermer, a cabal with fringe group characteristics, they also push a spurious methodology. On page 212 of his book, Why People Believe Weird Things, Shermer lists the following points. 1. Revisionists concentrate on their opponent's weak points, while rarely saying anything definitive about their own position. 2. They exploit errors made by scholars who are opposing arguments, implying that because a few of their opponents' conclusions were wrong, all of their opponents' conclusions must be wrong. They use quote three, they use quotations, usually taken out of context, from prominent mainstream figures to buttress their own position. Four, they mistake genuine, honest debate about the existence of the entire field. Five, they focus on what is not known and ignore what is known, emphasize data that fit and discount data that do not fit. Shermer claims that it is by a convergence of evidence, as he puts it, that the historical reality of the Holocaust becomes apparent. He cites a few things, five in all, as evidence, and as convergence of evidence position. Written documents, eyewitness testimony, photographs, physical evidence, and demographics. When we weave all of these together, presumably the historical reality of the Holocaust becomes clear. What the Holocaust revisionist does, Shermer claims, is nibble at the edges and take pot shots at weak points in the entire Holocaust narrative. He claims that there is no central position in Holocaust revisionism around which stands a core of scientifically grounded claims. What it is, according to Shermer, is pseudoscience. Now, pseudoscience is the presumed use of science that actually masks an unscientific methodology. Shermer reduces revisionist claims to a straw man, arguing that, like the biblical creationist, the revisionist requests just one proof for a central directive for the Holocaust. So it's pseudoscience, and it's made up of straw men. However, Holocaust revisionism is wholly different from biblical creation science. The central revisionist claim is that there was no Holocaust. There was no central or top-down imperative to exterminate the whole of Europe's Jews. The central creationist claim is that species were separately created by an intelligent designer. Thus, revisionism makes a claim, or set of claims, that confines its agents and causes to quantifiable historical parameters, without invoking agencies that cannot be directly observed or otherwise traced in documentation. The revisionist holds that the Holocaust narrative does not stand scientific scrutiny. While it does indeed not deny that Jews died in World War II, it rejects the claim that this was the result of intent or an implicit or explicit order for genocide. This differs drastically in method and substance from claims made by creation scientists. Unlike the creationist, whose explanations for natural history and our origins are based on the use of supernatural agency, entities outside of the reach or grasp of science, the revisionist maintains itself within the confines of history. He does not invite into his explanations anything outside of the documented historical record and remains within the confine of facts. There's a radical difference between biblical creation science and historical revisionism, and especially Holocaust revisionism. Essentially, the argument reduces to a sort of ad hominem. Characterizing revisionism and those groups that are devoted to it as some kind of cult or fringe group, and describing as weird, as implied in the title of this book, anyone that does not accept the establishment narrative of World War II and the Holocaust, stem from Shermer's own political and ethical views. He is a political liberal and a globalist. He dismisses any concern for the future of people of European descent. In his essay, The New Revisionism, he claims that an aristocratic romance is really what drives revisionism. The following is from his essay. Shermer says, "Extermination of masses of people racially or ethnically different from those in power is the logical outcome of the aristocratic romance and the belief that there is or can be such a thing as a pure race and ethnicity. There is no such thing, of course, as modern genetic science has unequivocally demonstrated." Every person on Earth comes from a single population of 1,000 to 10,000 individuals who migrated out of Africa and began to colonize Europe and the rest of the world sometime between 100,000 and 160,000 years ago. Black Australian Aborigines, for example, are genetically more closely related to Southeast Asians than they are to black Africans because the route of migration was from Africa through Southeast Asia into Australia. The similarities between Australian Aborigines and Africans and the differences they show with Southeast Asians are literally only skin deep. The principle holds for all people around the world, peoples around the world, and our racial similarities vastly outweigh our racial differences. And he ends with, "We are one race, one folk, one people." Now, Shermer, of course, is very fond of ad hominems, reductio ad nazisms, and arguments that reduce our positions to straw men that most, of course, would reject. Lurking even deeper, however, in his position is his own pseudoscience. Of course, modern science demonstrates that we all have a shared ancestry. No committed nationalist that holds evolution to be a valid explanation for the history of life and its diversity denies this. But shared ancestry does not imply that differences that exist now and are apparent in the present are illusions. There would be no diversity in the living world at all, among species and higher groups, if the sorts of differences that have emerged in nature hadn't differentiated and maintained their distinctions through preferential selection. We would not have the diversity that we have now in the living world without racial categories that ultimately differentiated into species. In other words, race is critical to comprehending evolution, and the implication is that we are following an established pattern and preferring our own kind that goes back to the primordial depths of life's history well over 3 billion years ago. Shermer is asking us to pretend that science has disproven race, evoking this pure race concept. The fact of shared ancestry does not discount diversity in the present, any more than chimpanzees, gorillas, and humans are all somehow identical and therefore irrelevant in their distinctions just because they share a common ancestor. What is driving many contemporary scientists is not a pursuit of objectivity, but a liberal program where the assumption of the weight of science backing fundamentally liberal claims exists. Shermer was closely affiliated with Stephen Jay Gould while the latter was alive. In fact, Gould wrote the foreword to Shermer's book, Why People Believe Weird Things. Gould, himself a Jew and a sympathizer with Marxism, is a prominent name in the scientific world. But his impact on people of European descent has been anything but constructive. Like Greg Johnson and Mark Weber, as I'll discuss in a bit, Shermer was significantly attached to Gould, who wrote books attacking genetically derived differences in performance grounded in race, and dedicated his life to a liberal, anti-racialist point of view. Greg Johnson's argument is that we can ignore revisionism as irrelevant to our aims because it doesn't get to the root of what he calls the psychological and ethical aspects of our current dilemma. An excellent treatment of his points can be found in Carolyn Yeager's essay on the White Network, entitled Everything Greg Johnson Knows About the Holocaust He Learned from Mark Weber. Another reply to Johnson's points was posted on the White Network, the essay by Thomas Dalton entitled Nationalism and the Holocaust, A Reply to Johnson. These already cover much ground and reveal many problems with Johnson's essay. What I wish to do is go to the root of Johnson's claims in his essay dealing with the Holocaust. I believe that there are two fundamentally flawed positions, one that I will call his Holocaust enough claim, and second, two, his argument from indifference. I think that there are two principal pillars, these claims are two principal pillars holding up his argument, and neither of them holds water. Some have argued that his points do not even deserve consideration or to be taken seriously. They should at least be understood as expressive for how people in our movement, in general, respond to pressure from the reality of Jewish power in our society. Johnson has simply made explicit an unfortunate tendency that is pervasive among us in our movement. Johnson's Holocaust Enough argument is that any number of Jewish deaths will amount to a Holocaust in Jewish eyes, and therefore it is irrelevant what revisionists reduce that number to. It is a Holocaust if it is 500,000 people or 6 million, he argues. Thus, it is a waste of time to pursue revisionism. One might interpret this as a concession to Jewish interest because of the reality of Jewish power, but there is probably also a deeper set of beliefs and norms operating in Johnson's thinking. He has made remarks sympathetic to Jews. A reference was included in the comment section of his article to Anne Frank, who, though she was counted among the victims of the Holocaust myth, actually died of typhus in the camp. Now that shows you the scope of what people consider to be the Holocaust and Holocaust victims. Therefore, Johnson is arguing that we should simply allow the Jews their Holocaust narrative, though it has been discredited by the hard work of revisionists. He is sympathetic to them. He has argued cleverly that we have a stake in the future existence of the State of Israel. His Holocaust Enough argument is driven by sympathy for Jews, not simply tactical considerations. This was partly demonstrated by the exchange we had in the comment section of his essay at the Occidental Observer. In some context that called for the issue, I discussed German Eastern foreign policy, which he described as imperialism most foul. Apparently, the history of the State of Israel, which he supports, is outside of the parameter of questioning, and its existence, in spite of decades of murder and bloodshed, should be supported. In fact, not just Germans, but the history of the entire white race comes under his scrutiny, even if implicitly, in a so-called New Right critique of imperialism and colonialism. What is equally perplexing with his support for the Jewish state in Palestine is his deliberate disregard for the history of European Americans. Had there not been colonialism, which he decries as imperialism most foul, there would be no European Americans. Fundamentally, what his position, not rare in our movement, achieves are modified grounds for guilt. By damning a large segment of the history of our race, Johnson does not achieve the moral high ground he and his New Right desire. Rather, they remove the primordial basis for our own existence today. And just as Johnson simultaneously supports the State of Israel but damns the German people for past aggression, he also asks us to pause and consider how awful we have been in the past and the cruelty implicit in the colonialism that gave rise to us. Johnson's other argument, his argument from indifference, is tied to his Holocaust Enough argument. Johnson argues that it is morally obtuse quibbling to demand a precise definition of the Holocaust, because in doing so it displays insensitivity to Jews who are innocent but have suffered. This is a serious problem among us, even established revisionists. What Irving unfortunately calls the Jewish tragedy in the preface of his book, Hitler's War, is the same kind of categorizing that Johnson engages in. It is to submit to the reality of Jewish pressure, in some cases directly even sympathize with it, as it is evident in the preface of Irving's Hitler's War, by pretending that Jews are somehow exceptional when they are not. There were many people that died, and several groups that suffered in World War II. It's a form of cowardice for us to submit to the particularity of Jewish interests. Revisionism is not necessarily a conscious or deliberate effort to revise the past from some academic vantage. That's not the sum of it. It is the result of an organic response to the reality of interplay of forces among us, some of which are deliberately antagonistic to us. This is where both Schirmer and Johnson err in their thinking. It's rooted in who we are. We revise the past when we're confronted with the problem or the question of how the past might be used against us now. Just as Schirmer has a liberal and globalist impulse in his presumably scientific deconstruction of our race, there are motivations that drive us to seek the truth in regard to that segment of the human species to which we belong. People of European descent are not social constructs. They are part of the diversity of life that nature has produced, and as such they naturally and instinctively act in accord with those interests. Mythologizing about an unnecessary war and the events that occurred and it inevitably leads to questioning. This is where Johnson errs, because you cannot pretend that revisionism is irrelevant, because the reality of the power of our enemy is every day present, and their myths, the impulse to produce empathy for their suffering, are also ever present. We have to find our own path away from these sorts of narratives, which revisionism has already shown to be false. Clinging to them because of the continued presence of a powerful enemy is not an escape. It's an imprisonment. I thank you for joining me on an hour by the window tonight, and I hope you have a good week, and I really hope to see you next week. Thank you for joining.